Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good afternoon. This is the Zoo digital presentation for our prelim results for the year to March 18. A health warning for you to read at your leisure, and there's contents here for the material that we'll go through in the course of the next period of time. So the backdrop to the Zoo business is we work in the home entertainment industry. We work for producers of feature films and TV series. And this is an industry that has been going through some quite fundamental change over the past 10 plus years. But over the last 2 years has gone through a period of transition as the predominant method for consumers to engage with this content has shifted from physical products, DVDs and Blu-ray discs, to digital services. So streaming video on demand and transactional video on demand services. So our clients are producers in the main of feature films and TV series. And what we do for them is enable them to take their materials and commercialize them all around the world. And what that entails is two main things. Firstly, this content must be adapted into local languages for audiences worldwide so that it can be understood and enjoyed. And secondly, there are many different routes to market now, certainly many digital channels through which content owners can deliver their programs to consumers. And each of those digital channels has its own particular way in which the content has to be prepared so it's in the right technical formats to be delivered. So what we do for our clients is provide them with services, and those services involve us receiving usually completed programs from them and doing all the work necessary to localize them into different languages through using subtitling and dubbing, and also do all what we call the digital packaging to assemble the materials together in the right technical formats so they can be delivered through different channels. So our clients include, you know, the biggest names in the home entertainment industry, major Hollywood studios, the BBC, a number of the leading digital platforms that are providing streaming and transactional services to consumers. So I'll start with the actual prelim results, and in particular, here I'm starting with the key performance indicators that we're intending to use as we move the business forward. So we've picked out three financial and two operational KPIs that we will be using to track our progress. The first of them is revenue, unsurprisingly. And as you will have seen, we grew revenue over the course of the last financial year by 73%, taking figure up to $28.6 million. So we report all our financials in US dollars. And the bulk of that growth has come from localization services. And I'll return to that in a moment and give you a breakdown of that. The second KPI financial is EBITDA margin. So we have a business which is operationally geared, and that over time we expect the contributions from our different segmental revenue lines to drop through at EBITDA level. But as you can see in the year to March 18, that's taken a step backwards. And that was a planned change where we have taken a conscious decision to invest in our new dubbing platform and services, which again we'll speak of in more detail in a moment. And that investment has obviously had an impact on the reported EBITDA figure. There are also some changes that are taking place within the mix and the blended margins we're seeing out of our different segments. And again, we'll return to that in a moment. Our business is operationally geared. And as the business grows and we increase our turnover, we expect that our OPEX will decrease as a proportion of sales. So OPEX as a percentage of revenue is one of the KPIs. And as you can see over this period, that has been decreasing. And I should take this opportunity just to clarify that we have made a change in this set of results, and that change will apply going forward, in the way in which we categorize cost of sale. So in previous periods, we have only included in our cost of sale the external direct costs of fulfilling our service. And those costs have been predominantly translators and more recently, voice actors who were providing dubbing services. But from this set of counts onwards, in cost of sale, we'll be including all direct costs that relate to fulfilling those revenue streams. So as well as the external direct costs, we'll also be including the internal ones, which are predominantly the cost of staff who are employed in order to fulfill those projects. So on that new basis of calculating a gross profit figure, if we now look at the OPEX as a percentage of revenue, as you can see, it's doing the right thing. And as we scale the business up, that's becoming a smaller proportion of the total. Our expectations would be that there would be an ongoing increase in our OPEX spend as we expand the business further, but the rate of that increase will be far less than you've seen previously. And in overall terms, as a percentage of sales, that should continue to come down. There are two operational KPIs that we're going to be reporting. The first concerns our capacity. So the zoo secret sauce, what differentiates us in the market from the services we provide, is the software platforms that we've developed that give us competitive advantage, enable us to deliver the services that we offer much more efficiently than our competitors, and we're able to pass on many benefits that accrue from the use of those systems. Those systems automate many parts of managing the process of localization and digital packaging. And wherever possible, we'll implement in our software capabilities so that we can automate things where that makes sense. But there are certain key areas where we still need people. And in the main, at the moment, those areas are in relation to linguistic type services. So we need human translators, because although machine translation in some applications is now used very effectively, in our market, where the subject matter is dialogue, which is very contextual and nuanced and idiomatic, machine translation at the moment doesn't really have the capability to be able to automate the translation. So consequently, we still use human translators. And we also, as now that we're engaged in dubbing, which we've been working on for the past year or so, we also have freelancers who work in that area too. So voice actors, dubbing directors, and audio mixing engineers. Unlike our competitors that would often have many of these folks on their payroll, in our case, all of these individuals are a scalable external resource. They're all freelancers, and we engage with them very efficiently through our cloud-based systems over the internet. So the number of freelancers that we have at any time is in effect defining the capacity that we have to provide those kinds of services across the different languages. So clearly, we have a mandate to grow that network. Previously, it's really been about getting more and more translators, but now that we're involved in dubbing as well, it's about adding the number of voice actors and dubbing directors and audio mixing engineers. So we grew over the year that network to over 4,000, which is more than double the prior year figure. And in fact, since since the end of March 18, that number is now up to about 5,000 freelancers. So we're really making great progress in expanding that pool of talent. And we've been very thorough and careful about how we select individuals so that we can be sure that they're capable and can deliver services of the required quality. The final KPI, an operational one, is to give an indication of the satisfaction of our customers for whom we do this work. And in many ways, customer satisfaction in our world is a function of the quality of services that you're providing. In order to do this work for the leading providers in the industry, you must deliver subtitles and dubbed audio to the very highest quality. So, but of course, quality is quite a subjective thing to measure. So rather than try and measure quality, we are reflecting our ability to continue to serve our clients, who clearly must be happy if we're retaining that business. And we are tracking the retained sales from one period that continues into the next. So this is a revenue-weighted client contribution and how that is moving over time. And as you can see, over this period, we've maintained a very high retention level. The four key operational highlights we picked out for this set of results. Firstly, we are continuing to grow subtitling at a very significant pace. We have more than we've almost doubled sales of subtitling services over this period compared with prior year. In the case of dubbing, we've obviously introduced dubbing services in this period, and that has got off to a cracking start. We'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. Our network of freelance workers, as we've spoken of already, has expanded, more than doubled over the period. And we've also added a number of affiliates. So these are companies that we work with in territory that give us points of presence in key countries where we have a need to recruit voice actors, translators, as well as access to recording spaces. So they're an important part of our strategy. And again, I'll expand on that again at the moment. And then finally, we just wanted to really confirm that there's nothing that seems to have changed about the market that would suggest there is, this is going away anytime soon. This is a fantastic growth area. There is more and more content that's being produced and commissioned, particularly by the leading streaming video services. And the demand for languages continues to grow. This content is going into more and more countries, and that's all leading to the need for more services of the kind that Zoo provides. I just want to take a moment just to talk about how the home entertainment market has changed over the years. And home entertainment has its origins in videotape. And in fact, videotape was for almost 30 years the dominant way in which we as consumers would consume home entertainment content, feature films particularly, and less so TV series during that era. The period within which the transition from tape to disc was such that disc was the dominant platform was relatively short, only about 8 years. This era is the period when the bulk of revenues in the industry were generating from sales of DVDs mainly, and Blu-ray to a degree. So the switch over to the digital era, when the bulk of content is being consumed mainly in the form of streaming video, that happened as recently as 2016. So there was quite a long transition away from physical towards to digital services. With those changes, one of the things that has also changed is the business model by which we as consumers acquire this content. So in the tape era, predominantly that was all about rental. It was about going down to a video store and renting tapes. And then as we moved into the disc era, sell-through and purchase of discs became very popular. But as we're now in this digital era, subscription has taken over as being the dominant means by which this content is commercialized. So for a content producer, the landscape now looks actually quite very different from the way it did in the days of DVD. There are lots more channels, routes to market. Figuring out how to maximize the return on investment of producing this content is a much more difficult thing to figure out. A key consideration in this change within the marketplace for Zoo is the effect that these changes have had on the demand for localization services. So in the tape era, because these tapes were expensive to produce and to get through the supply chain, there are very few products that would have a market globally, or at least that were viable for studios and other content producers to deliver on a global basis. So consequently, during that era, relatively few languages were used to localize content. That did take a significant step up during the disc era, and in particular DVD made it possible to much more cost effectively reach more territories. But that step up has been nothing like the transition that we've seen as we've moved into digital distribution. So for a content owner now, working with some of the leading global providers of these streaming services, it's possible to reach pretty much the whole world and audiences in practically every language. So that has created enormous demand for localization into many more languages than were ever viable in the past. So those dynamics all lead to a very vibrant opportunity for Zoo and companies who are providing these kinds of services. As I mentioned earlier, what sets Zoo apart is our technology platform. So fundamentally, we are a very innovative company that has an internal team of 25 people who are engaged in R&D, developing these software platforms, these cloud computing platforms that provide for us this competitive advantage. These platforms are central to everything that we do. They're used by our staff. They're used by that network of 5,000 freelancers. They are used by our affiliate partners in territory. They're used by, in some cases, by our clients who are using them to submit orders to us and to extract the deliverables from the work that we do. So these platforms are fundamental to our strategy, and they are the thing that sets us apart and gives us the competitive advantage we have in the market. Zoo, as a business, came to the AIM market in 2001, and under a different management team, had a different focus at that time. So the current business plan actually has its origins in 2006, which is the year in which I became CEO. And since that time, we have been investing heavily in the development of technology. So the platforms that we're now using to provide these services have been developed over 10 or more years. So there's a significant investment in the technology platforms, which provide us with some degree of a barrier to entry for others to come into the space and to attempt to replicate the things that we do. I'll just take a moment just explaining how our technology can revolutionize some of the processes that take place within this industry. And for this, I'll focus specifically on dubbing. So if I spend a moment just explaining the way in which dubbing is performed in a traditional business. So that's all of our competitors who offer these services currently. Essentially, it is a proposition that traditionally has been very much wedded to a physical operation. So a so-called dubbing studio that will be in territory, that will provide recording spaces and control rooms with mixing desks and digital audio workstations, and we'll have recording engineers on staff who do all that's necessary to do all the to capture all these recordings. So if you want to dub into multiple languages, typically you will need to work with multiple dubbing studios, because in each case, the studio needs to call on voice actors, and those voice actors typically will reside in the target country. So that means if you want to dub into French, you will probably work with a dubbing studio in Paris, and that studio will call on voice actors who are living relatively local to the studio itself. So a characteristic of the traditional way of dubbing is that it's very much centered around infrastructure. It's capital intensive. There are lots of people on the payroll providing technical functions as well as creative functions. They are drawing on a limited catchment area of voice actors in order to avoid incurring expensive travel and hotel expenses. And it is fundamentally limited in its capacity. So if a dubbing studio has, say, 4 recording spaces, then clearly at any one time there can only be 4 actors recording their voices for a particular project. So if a project is to take, say, a drama series that runs in 20 episodes of 45 minutes each, and over the course of those 20 episodes there are maybe 50 different characters, all of which need to be voiced into that target language, then that's quite a big undertaking. And for the dubbing studio that's doing that work in its language, there's quite a significant diarization challenge to arrange for all those, all of the voices that are being cast against those characters to come in one by one to do their recordings in these recording spaces. So in summary, it has scalability constraints, it's expensive, it takes a long time, it's quite error prone, it requires highly skilled technical and creative operators to be present throughout the process. So Zoo has taken a very disruptive and very clearly differentiated approach that we've termed, that's been coined in the industry, cloud dubbing. And in simple terms, you can think of us as having sort of created a virtual recording studio in the cloud. And what that means for us is that, of course, we still need spaces in which voice actors can record their voices to a high quality, but we don't require those voice actors to travel to any specific location. And in fact, what we found is many voice actors who offer their services in the industry will often have their own home recording setup. So not an expensive studio, but perhaps a spare room in their home where they have spent a little bit of money on some acoustic treatment. They have a $150 microphone and an internet connection. And that, we have found in most cases, is adequate to capture recordings of the quality needed in order to fulfill this market. So for us, we're working with voice actors who could be located anywhere in the world. They typically will be using either their own recording spaces, or they may travel to a local recording studio to capture their voices. And our software manages the process of dubbing. So it basically instructs them at every step of the way what they need to do and guides them through that process. We still have the opportunity to engage the so-called dubbing directors in the process. But in our ecosystem, unlike the traditional one where they would typically be present in the studio, in the control room, in our scenario, these dubbing directors can be located anywhere in the world and will be interacting over the internet with these voice actors. So in summary, our approach is radically different from that traditional scenario. It doesn't have the requirements for capital investment. We don't have to spend money building studios. We have practically unlimited capacity because we're drawing on recording spaces that exist all around the world. And typically our capacity is constrained actually by the number of voice actors we have rather than the recording spaces. We don't have to have recording engineers and dubbing directors present throughout this process because the software is performing many of their functions. But we still have the option to engage dubbing directors where it's appropriate in order to ensure that the recordings are done of the required quality. So we have a very scalable solution, a very cost-effective means of doing this work, access to a huge resource of voice actors located all around the world, and we can turn projects around very quickly to a high standard at a very competitive price point. We've highlighted the four key principles of our strategy. And I'll take you through these and the progress that we've made in the year that we've just reported. The first of these is, as you would expect, innovation. It's about our investment in technology and these platforms that give us this competitive advantage. During the course of the year, we have launched our first our dubbing platform and introduced this cloud dubbing service for the first time. We've also developed and deployed a scripting platform, which essentially allows us to deliver certain scripting services to our clients. And that also provides a very efficient way to dovetail into the subtitling and dubbing processes that we perform downstream. And over the course of the year, we've received a number of accolades, industry awards for innovation in our industry. The second key component of our strategy is around scalability, and that of course comes from this resource of freelance workers who engage with us. The software itself is inherently scalable, so the software will naturally scale up to accommodate whatever volume of work we process at any time. So for us, scalability is actually a function of the network of freelance workers who we're working with. And as I mentioned already, we've more than doubled that number in the year, and we're on a very good growth trajectory. We've also completed a couple of significant hires in recent months. Two folks who were formerly Disney execs, one in Asia, one in for Latin America, who bring with them lots of experience and contacts in the industry, in the area of dubbing, that's very valuable to us. The third component of our strategy is around these affiliates that I mentioned earlier. So affiliates are important to us in that they give us a point of presence in key countries. And that's important to us for certain services that we may need to engage in those countries, and also to provide access to key talent, including voice actors, dubbing directors, and translators. And in return, we allow those partners to have access to our software systems in order to fulfill work for their clients in territory. And in some cases, we will overflow certain kinds of work to those affiliates and engage them to do work on our behalf. Over the course of the year, we've added a number of affiliates in key territories in Asia Pacific and in the Middle East. The fourth component of our strategy is around the way in which we engage with our clients. And many of the largest buyers in this industry have their own approved or preferred vendor programs, where every period they will select the organizations they intend to work with in key areas of spend. And that's typically true of localization. So our aim is, to the extent that a prospective client operates those kinds of programs, our intention is to be one of those preferred vendors. And as we reach the end of our 18-year. We were and still are an approved vendor for 5 of the 6 major Hollywood studios and for 3 of the leading digital distributors providing global services for video content. Moving on to the financial statements, in our P&L, from this point on, we are measuring gross profit as being revenue less both external and internal direct costs. So as a consequence, the 17 figures have been restated, but only insofar as there are certain costs that previously appeared as OPEX that have now moved into cost of sale. But otherwise, you know, that doesn't affect in any way the profitability of the business. But it provides a more representative way of looking at the business and how it's performing. So as we said already, sales have risen by 73% to $28.6 million. I guess a couple of things that I would pick out of this are particularly some items in the finance section of the P&L after EBITDA. So the company has a convertible loan note. It is for a sum of just over 2.5 million sterling. It runs until October 2020. It carries a coupon of 7.5% and a conversion price of 48 pence. And in previous periods, that loan note was underwater. So the share price was trading at a level below 48p. And as a consequence of that, the way in which that was represented in our balance sheet was that it was treated as though it was straight debt. But now that the share price is a good way above that 48p conversion price, it has to be treated for finance purposes as an embedded derivative. And for that reason, there is a charge that we have to show in the finance section of the P&L and that is mirrored in our balance sheet that corresponds to a fair value of that embedded derivative in the loan note. And as you can see, that gives rise to a $4.7 million charge in 2018. So it's important to understand that is it's purely an accounting treatment. There's absolutely no cash impact on it. In fact, the expectation is, of course, that the loan note at its term will actually convert into equity rather than be repaid. So there will be no consequential charge that the business receives beyond the issue of equity to satisfy that conversion of debt. In addition, because the convertible is denominated in sterling and we report in US dollars, we have to, the date of every balance sheet, we have to value the sterling denominated loan note in dollars, and that obviously will give to changes as the exchange rates move. So in the prior year, that flattered the P&L by $600K, whereas in the current year, it's led to a roughly $500K charge. So clearly there's been a $1.1 million movement in a line in our P&L, which again, there is no, and there will be no cash impact. So it's purely an accounting treatment, but which can lead to a kind of confusing picture on the P&L. Lastly, there is a charge here, $115K in the year for conversion of loan into equity. So $500K sterling of the loan note was converted last April at 9p, which was the price of a placing that we did at that time. And that again gave rise to a charge that we have to show through the P&L, which is again has no cash impact. So in fact, it's only the finance cost that is in the finance section here that actually would have any cash implication, and that corresponds obviously to the cost of servicing the loan note, that 7.5% coupon, as well as some other finance charges to do with leases on equipment, other things. So of those revenues, let me just spend a moment talking about the segments. So there are 3 segments in which we operate, and again, going forward, we'll provide this level of detail in our reports. The 3 segments are firstly localization, which embraces subtitling and dubbing and captioning as well. Captioning is to do with providing, for example, subtitles for the deaf and hard of hearing. So similar to, but a little bit different from subtitling. All those services are bundled together in this one localization segment. The second category is digital packaging, which is to do with preparing the materials in the right technical format so they can be delivered through these different channels. And that includes DVD and Blu-ray disc, as well as the these digital platforms. And then the third category is software licensing, where we receive revenues through clients using our software and paying us fees for that software. So taking a look at how the progress that we've made, as you can see, moving from 17 to 18, the growth has really all come from this localization segment, where we've grown the top line by almost 150% to $21.4 million in the period. And the bulk of that growth, as I mentioned earlier, has come from subtitling, which has more than doubled in the period. And we've also included in the year 7 months of sales of dubbing services, which were introduced in the period. What you're seeing in the margins on localization is a transition. So you see that there's been an improvement in margins from 17 to 18. And that's a combination of two things. It's a combination of the maturity of our subtitling services, which we've been delivering now for 5 years, and where we're now delivering healthy contribution margins, but which have improved since 2017. But in 2018, we also have initial revenues from sales of dubbing services. And in these early stages of dubbing, what's absolutely essential is that we provide services of highest quality to our clients. And because we're at the very beginning of offering these really very challenging new services to major clients in the industry, we're being very cautious about how we proceed there. So we're ensuring as we progress in these early stages that we've got surplus capacity to perform those projects so that we, if we do encounter problems along the way, we have the time and the capacity in order to remedy those problems in order that the client, the quality of what the client receives is not compromised in any way. So that together with other investments that we're making in dubbing, and some of those investments are represented now in the cost of sales line, others are represented in that OPEX line, that is contributing to a suppressed margin that we're reporting in 18 for localization. The second category, digital packaging, is more than half of the number of the sales number here comes from services, legacy services for the zoo business in providing solutions for DVD and Blu-ray. And those are good margin services. But in digital packaging, there are a number of different service lines. So you're seeing kind of a blend of those service lines in the margins. So what we saw in the period was that whilst the other service lines of digital packaging grew, there was a decline in the Blu-ray and DVD work, which reflects the natural decline that's happening within the industry as this continuing movement away from physical products towards digital. So certainly, there are plenty of title switch DVDs and Blu-rays are still viable, and they will, I'm sure, continue to be produced for some time. But the number of titles that are viable is reducing over time. And therefore, we expect, and in the forecasts that have been prepared by our analysts, the working assumption is that DVD and Blu-ray will continue to decline. So the reduction in sales here is largely a consequence of the decline that we've seen as expected in DVD and Blu-ray. And because of those contributing at a higher margin, that's actually gave rise to a decline in the contribution margin from that segment. The third category, software licensing, is mostly to do with legacy products, actually. Products that we've developed over the last 15 years that we license to major Hollywood studios and others that generates very high quality recurring revenues. That's declined slightly over the period, but obviously provides very high contribution margins. So in the mix, overall, in 17, we, based on this new categorization of cost of sales, then we saw a gross profit of 45%. That declined in the period to 35, but moving forward, the expectation is that as we expand our services, particularly around dubbing and improve margins there, that we should see an improvement in that gross profit contribution. on the balance sheet. I guess a couple of things to pick out here. Firstly, the increase in trade and other receivables. As you can see, year on year, that's taken a very significant increase, roundly doubled in the period. And that is totally a consequence of the growth that we're seeing in the business. In fact, more than 95% of what's in that number has subsequently, since year end, been converted into cash. So we are, there's no issue with collection of receivables. It's really what you're seeing there is just a function of the growth that's happening within the business. A couple of other things to note, the convertible loan notes that I mentioned at this point last year was had until October 17 as its maturity date. And so in the previous year's set of accounts, that had fallen into current liabilities. But at the same time we did the placing last April, we also agreed with loan note holders to extend the term of that loan note out of a further 3 years to October 20. So another change that you're seeing here is a movement of that, the value in that convertible loan moving from a current liability into a non-current. You see also here the value of the fair value of the embedded derivative is also appearing in the non-current liabilities as kind of part of the borrowings section. In cash, we've generated cash. So for a company that's growing at over 70% in this period, we have still been able, which and clearly businesses in that mode would typically be consuming cash, we've still managed to generate cash. And clearly, as I said, a lot of cash was actually tied up in receivables at the year-end position, which has subsequently been converted. In terms of the growth potential for the business, I refer again to the research from last year that was undertaken by the Media and Entertainment Services Alliance, so an independent group that looks specifically at our market and the expenditure on the kind of services that we provided. They restricted their study to Europe, Middle East, and Africa, so I don't have a worldwide figure. I'm just looking at that region. But this figure, you can think of that as an addressable market figure. So it is specifically for the very services that we as a business provide. What MESA found was that market was last year growing at a rate of over 10% per year. We don't have a figure for the worldwide market, but our guesstimate would be that it could be twice that number. So a very significant market opportunity. And a market that is growing at a really quite an incredible rate of over 10%, and that growth is being fueled by the expansion of these digital services. And important to note that the biggest segment of that media localization market is in dubbing. That's not because more content is dubbed than is subtitled, it's because the cost of dubbing is so much more than subtitling, and that skews the expenditure in the market in favor of dubbing. When thinking about the quality of the revenues that Zoo receives, other than that recurring software licensing income that I spoke of earlier, it's important to recognize that our business is mostly what you would call repeatable rather than recurring. So we have framework agreements in place with very big buyers within this industry. And that means that in practice, you know, pretty much every day, those clients place more orders with us for work. But those projects, that work is to complete particular projects, and those projects might require a few days or a few weeks for us to process and deliver. The consequence of that is that the visibility that we have over revenues is actually quite short, 2 to 3 months. And one of the consequences of that is that it makes forecasting rather challenging, and the risk factors associated with that in some way contribute to the forecasts that have been placed in the market by the analysts. But obviously, I'd remind you again, you know, if when we look at that retained revenue KPI that I mentioned earlier on, that in practice, you know, our big clients continue to work with us, and we don't have any attrition to those big clients. The business is operationally geared, as I said, and our KPI around OPEX as a percentage of revenue will demonstrate that as we move the business forward. And I think an important point to recognize about our business compared with our competitors is that we can scale this up organically without requiring significant capital expenditure. Take a few moments just to touch on the management team. So we have a board of three execs and two independent non-execs, all of whom have experience of capital markets in technology businesses. So I wanted to highlight a transition that we're going through at the moment. So our CFO of 18 years, Helen Gilder, took the decision earlier this year to step down and for personal reasons to move on to other projects. And we have spent since that time in a search for a successor. And I'm pleased that we announced on Monday that that will be Phil Blundell, who comes with experience as a finance professional in AIM-quoted businesses with a career spanning 20 years in the tech sector. So he's previously had CFO roles with, most recently, with Digital Group PLC, and prior to that with Eagle Eye Solutions and with Intelligent Environments. The business operates predominantly out of two production centres, one in Sheffield in the UK, the other in Los Angeles. Other than a small office that we have in London, we are able to provide services on a worldwide basis out of those two locations. We're a very innovative company, as you would imagine. We're always looking for ways in which we can inject our R&D efforts in order to change the way in which things are done to improve efficiencies, enable us to pass on more benefits to our clients. And that is provided by our R&D team based in Sheffield, where we employ 25 software engineers and other professionals. Just a few words about the roadmap. So that resource, those 25 people, we spend just over $1 million per year on that resource, of which about half is expensed and half is capitalized, which is a requirement of IFRS. And we view that resource as being our investment in technology in order to be able to deliver us these competitive advantages in the services that we offer. So before we came along, the types of technology that were available in the industry to undertake the kind of services that we offer have been really quite rudimentary. And if you think about, for example, the challenges around managing projects that go through organizations like ours, many of our competitors are using tools as simple as Excel spreadsheets and email in order to communicate with and track projects amongst many different collaborators. So what we have done is obviously created purpose-designed tools as cloud software platforms that give us these competitive advantages. And we will continue to invest. So although, you know, we have these platforms in place now that are enabling us to deliver subtitling and dubbing and digital packaging services, there are still plenty of opportunities that we see to continue to refine, enhance, extend their capability in order to make us more efficient, to be able to pass on more benefits to our clients, to enable us to process more volumes and generate more revenue. So in the period ahead, the key areas that we'll be focusing in our software product development around further initiatives to deliver security features in our systems. We'll be integrating the digital packaging components with our localization systems, again, to make things much more streamlined and efficient. Because one of the things that we anticipate is that increasingly our clients will want to bundle together digital packaging and localization with the vendors that they're working with. We'll also continue to find opportunities in the area of dubbing for activities that we can automate to make more efficient. We have kicked off in the last few months a research collaboration with an academic partner around machine learning, particularly in speech technologies. And that should yield capabilities that would be very beneficial to our dubbing services. And finally, casting, which is essentially in these foreign languages, selecting the voice actors who will provide the voices for each of the parts of the screen actors. that process, we're going to be expanding the feature set in our systems to enable that to be done by our clients if they need to, so they have access to our database of talent and can potentially audition different voice actors in different roles. So finally, the investment summary and our outlook is that you have a sense that we're operating in a very large market. You know, it's at least $2 billion, perhaps as big as twice of that. So that's an addressable market that is growing rapidly. We have a defensible position with a very clear competitive advantage by virtue of the investment we've made over 10 plus years in our technology platforms. We have very strong relationships, long-term relationships with many of the biggest buyers of these services in the industry. And we're able to generate good margins from those services and to generate cash, which has already been demonstrated. I should say that in the past, in terms of those client relationships, we have historically had quite a dependence on a particular client. And one of the focuses of the business has been to kind of diversify the client base and reduce client concentration. And one of the things we reported in this set of results was that our largest client, which previously had accounted for more than 80% of our sales in prior years, and last year accounted for 44%, that had fallen to 34% in the current year, and with the second largest client contributing about 24% of our sales. So we're making good strides in terms of the diversification of our revenue sources. We have a strong and strategic management team, and further strengthened as with Phil Lindell joining us. We've got a sales pipeline that continues to grow across all our offerings, and great opportunity for continued growth in the future. And we're very confident of achieving ongoing organic growth as we take this business forward. Happy to take questions, as long as they're not about embedded derivatives.
You highlighted the large clients you have. Is there a situation where certain studios or streaming services that you don't have as a client at the moment wouldn't take you because of the work you do for other studios, etc., or is that not a situation?
We don't see any evidence of that. So neither between the actual content producers. So so I think your point is still valid when you said, you know, one film studio compared with another. One film studio say, well, because you work with our competitors, we won't use you? So we don't see it there, and we don't see it across the digital platforms. And the reason for that is that the service that we're offering is very specialized. It's quite niche. You know, it's a component of the much bigger global localization services industry, which is, you know, a $50 billion worldwide market. Yeah. So we're dealing with a niche but high value segment of that wider market. And because of the very specialist nature of what we do for media localization, which requires very specialist skills, as a consequence, the people who provide media localization tend to just do that. And the big players in localization more generally tend not to try to cover the specialist area. So for example, the translators who do this kind of work we're working with a subset of the general kind of translators who are out there. Because media translation requires really quite specific skills. It requires an understanding of, you know, colloquialisms and humor and cultural references and all sorts of things that go way beyond the usual expectations of a translator who, for example, is engaged to translate a user manual into another language.
Just like to try and get a handle on what your average price is on dubbing. How much do you charge per minute, roughly? Or, I assume when you started it, you've taken on more basic work. As you go on, you're going to take on more value-added, higher standard dubbing work. I just wonder, can you give us an idea of the average price of what you might start with and where you're heading?
Okay, so if I just spend a moment just expanding on what dubbing means, really, and the and the different kinds of projects that are commissioned. There's much more variability in that than there is in subtitling. You know, with subtitling, generally, you know, with a client, we agree a rate based on the runtime of the program. So it's quoted as a per minute rate. So if it's a 100-minute movie, we'll quote a rate for 1 minute and multiply it by 100, and that's the price that the client will pay. And similarly, we have a relationship with our translators who we remunerate on exactly the same basis. So although there's variability in subtitling between different languages, some languages are more expensive to produce than others, it's a pretty straightforward pricing matrix. With dubbing, there's far more variability. So the very first thing is that there are two main styles to dubbing. There is a style that's known as voiceover, sometimes called UN-style dubbing, where the foreign language voice speaks over the top of the existing voice that's in the program. So, for example, if you watched a news report with an interview with a foreign language speaker, you know, they'll start to speak in their language, and then you'll hear an actor basically giving you the translation over the top, sort of like an interpreter, as it were. So voiceover dubbing is that style, and it is used for certain genres of content. So particularly unscripted content is usually, I think, documentaries and reality TV type things will use that style. Also, it's a style that is traditionally used in certain countries. So in certain countries, it is the norm, even with drama series, to use voiceover dubbing. That's just the way that it works. So voiceover dubbing is relatively straightforward. And to your point, when we first implemented our dubbing platform, initially, it was capable of doing voiceover type projects. So the other main type of dubbing is referred to as lip sync dubbing, which is probably the style that we in this country are more familiar with if we see a dubbed program. With lip sync dubbing, what you're aiming to do is to create the illusion that the person on the screen who's speaking is actually speaking in that target language. And it's not always easy to achieve, but when it's done carefully and skillfully, it can be done in a relatively convincing way. And obviously to do that, you have to completely remove the original language voice, and the voice actors who are replacing their voices have to record their lines in a very carefully so that they not only convey the right emotional content that matches the original speaker, but also the timing of the delivery of their words in their target language gives a plausible match to the movement of the lips of this on-screen speaker. So that's quite a challenging ask. So that's much more complicated, it's more difficult, it takes more time, and therefore it costs more. So you've got those two factors, that factor, the style of dubbing that's used. And then you've also got a consideration for the number of voices that you will require in order to produce the content. So for example, if you're dubbing by voice over a documentary, which is a single voice that's narrating a program, then clearly that's a much simpler and quicker and cheaper thing to produce than if you've got a drama series that runs into 20 episodes and has 50 different screen actors, all of which you need to find voices for in each of the languages that you're going to dub. So it's hard to answer your question really and say that there is a kind of rule of thumb. There's quite a lot of variability. So what I would say is that in our ecosystem, we've got, because of our systems, tight control over the process and how things operate. And one of the things that we've implemented in the period is a cost estimator that we can make available to our clients. So one of the things that our clients can do is use their system to put in the parameters of their particular title. So it'll ask them, well, how many episodes of how many minutes and how many different voices. And of those voices, are any of the children? Because that's another factor that affects costs and so on. So they put in this information, and then this system will give them an estimate that actually is very accurate of what we would charge them in order to produce that kind of content. So that's very helpful. And one of the things that helps them to do is scenario planning when they're thinking about, okay, so which languages should we localize this? And also, one of the things it deals with is the incremental costs of doing the digital packaging for the different platforms. So they can say, well, if we were to go out through this channel, you know, what does that mean? How many languages do we need? And what would be incremental packaging costs for that? So, but overall, in terms of the place that we're operating in the industry, we're able to offer these services at competitive rates compared with the incumbent providers. And of course, one of the features of our proposition is that subject to having voice actors and dubbing directors in other languages, we, you know, our approach is language agnostic. So whereas the traditional providers, you know, a French, a Paris-based dubbing studio dubs into French. So through our platforms, we can dub into any language as long as we've got access to that talent. And this is something we highlighted in the statements for the results, that, you know, so we're effectively a one-stop shop, and we now have clients who are treating us as a one-stop shop and coming to us and say, well, here you go, take care of the whole thing for me, this digital packaging, the subtitling, and the dubbing for across the world.
So you can do voiceover, no problem now.
So back to your question. So voiceover, so for the first several months, 7-8 months that we were doing this, we were just focusing on voiceover projects whilst we were developing the capabilities for lip sync dubbing. And then from around the April, we had the capability in our systems to fully go ahead. You know, we'd done tests and early projects prior to them, but from April we said, okay, we're ready now to be offering lip sync dubbing. And so now when a client comes to us, subject to that capacity in our freelancer network, we can undertake any dubbing project.
The first question, do you read The Economist?
Not regularly, but I have read the article that you're
just about to ask you about. So you know what I'm going to ask you.
Good. I do.
HBO is expected to accelerate its move away from its premium base, investing in shows outside America, $2.5 billion on content this year, as will Hulu. Apple, $1 billion. Amazon, $4 billion. Netflix, it started turning non-English language shows into hits. Money Heist, a Spanish crime caper series, and Dark, a piece of German science fiction about missing children. 9 out of 10 people who watched Dark were from outside Germany. Upcoming releases are Hindi, Turkish superhero, Arabic, Shooting in a Man of Petra. They'll all be dubbed into a range of other languages, as Netflix English language shows are. Is that, to what extent do you think you can share? And is that an explosion of content, in your view, from your past experience?
It is. So, I mean, I can't obviously comment on the specifics
of the
particular.
No, the figures sound enormous.
Yes. So what we are observing is that there is more content that's been commissioned. Obviously, I mean, it takes a while. So when, you know, when one of these companies puts a budget aside to this, you know, you may not see the fruits of that for a year or more.
Yeah.
So, but the fact that more cash is being invested in original programming by these operators will yield clearly more content of a high quality that by definition will be delivered around the world, because these services are supplying consumers all around the world.
But also, it's the other way around. Normally, one expects people to be dubbing English language stuff into foreign languages for distribution around the world. It sounds as though it's going the other way now. Is that right?
So I think what we're seeing is, I think you're absolutely right, we are seeing more original content that is not in English that's travelling more widely. And I think digital distribution sort of gave a taste of some really interesting cases where, you know, content that was produced for one country that was really only ever thought to be applicable in that country suddenly has appeal in other countries that have a particular interest in those genres. And obviously what you're seeing there and the material you're quoting indicates what we're already seeing, which is that more content is coming to us that is not in English and that we are then adapting into other languages, including English.
But it's being brought to you by the big studios and the big digital providers.
Yes, in two forms. One, through their commissioning, and that's obviously, they've started to do that. We've not come through the other side of that yet. But more from the original programming that they are licensing in order to go into their platform. So they're looking to license, we've observed, content from other countries in order to take it out.
Can I ask you another question? It's about your affiliates. You let them use your software. How do you stop them pinching your software and using it for themselves? How do you guarantee that they aren't going to do that in some far-flung country like Thailand or Taiwan?
So the software is all cloud-based. So it's not like we give them a copy, they install it on their laptop, and they're off to, they can do whatever they want. Essentially, they're using it in a web browser. The software itself is running on servers that we control that are in the cloud. So we can control precisely what functionality we make available to them and how they use it. We can meter their usage of it. We can, you know, check the projects that they're working on. So we're in a position to kind of control their use.
Because it's cloud-based, they can't reverse engineer it.
That's right, because they don't have possession of the software. Yeah. What they have is the user interface, if you like, of the software.
Okay, thanks.
Could you say anything about the research initiative on machine learning? How would that sort of fit into what we do?
So the way in which we are operating at the moment is that we have, when we take on a dubbing project, for each language, we will assign a dubbing director to that language version. And the dubbing director is essentially the ultimate person responsible for the quality into that language. And they will play a part in casting, most likely, the voice actors who do the recording. And they will kind of oversee their work. And often what happens is that they, when the project starts, the dubbing director remotely will work with each voice actor to make sure they understand, you know, the motivation of the character that they're playing and how they should deliver the lines, and will probably oversee the first lines that they record until they're satisfied that voice actor kind of knows what they're doing, and then we'll kind of let them complete the project themselves. And then the next involvement from the dubbing director will be when all the recordings have been done. And the dubbing director will then review the program in its entirety and hear how the different voices interact and make sure that all works. And out of that, they will almost certainly find some lines that aren't quite right, and they will go back to those voice actors to help them to do what they need to do. When the voice actors are doing their recording, particularly for lip-sync dubbing, we have our interface provides a sort of karaoke-style interface view. So you see the video playing, and there's a marker on the screen, and there are words that are scrolling from right to left for most Western languages. And when those words cross that line, that's the point at which they should be spoken. And if the voice actor speaks the words at that point, there will be a good match to the lip sync. So what the voice actor has to do is to essentially themselves decide whether they've actually done a good take. And if they haven't, then they need to record it again and keep trying until they're satisfied that they've done that synchronization is good, and then they'll move on. Of course, the dubbing director at a later stage may disagree and come back to them and say, "Well, I still need you to do this." But as you can imagine, that's a process that requires the voice actor to be the judge, at least at that point in the process of the recording that they're making. So the idea behind the initiative that we've kicked off on research around machine learning is specifically for speech. And there are a number of different application areas that we see, but one of them is to provide assistance and support to the voice actors to help them to do a good job of that lip sync dubbing. So it will. So currently, for example, one of the things that it does already is to look at when the actor starts speaking and when they finish speaking, and to make sure that they basically match the on-screen speaker. And it will give them feedback. So if that doesn't match, it will say, sorry, that doesn't fit, you'll need to have another go. But at the moment, what we're not doing is measuring the quality of fit during the recording. So one of the things that we're looking at with this research project is to be able to analyze their recording and give them some feedback that in another setting would require a dubbing director. And of course, there may be projects where we have to have dubbing directors overseeing because the quality really requires that. And of course, we can do that in our ecosystem too. But our expectation is that these research initiatives will yield capabilities that should help us to enable our voice actors to be more time efficient in what they're doing, and also potentially to do a better quality job of what they're doing in terms of the accuracy of their lip sync work to the on-screen voices.
Stuart, going back to Nick's question, if you were to look at that matrix behind the estimator for your customers, what do you think the range might be for two figure, well, a range for dubbing, for lip syncing and voiceover in terms of all the different languages? Are we talking sort of $50 per minute up to 500, or is it, is there a cluster around 200, or what? Just give us a feel. What we're all trying to do is to try and work out, you know, try and create a model.
Yes.
And we're struggling.
Yes, and I think it's hard. So obviously one of the things that we've indicated is the rate at which we're stepping up the volume of dubbing work that we're doing. So in the first couple of months, when at the very beginning, we were doing 30 hours a month, roughly, on average. And then for the next 6 months, so that was the second half of our year, we'd step that up to about 80 hours a month of completed dubbing output. And then subsequent to year end, in the last 2-3 months, we've done more like 150 hours a month. And at the moment, whilst we're in these early stages, we are in effect constraining, we're sort of imposing a cap on what we're prepared to do, within which we are comfortable that we've got surplus capacity, so that if there are issues that arise because a new version of the software doesn't quite work, or we encounter some particular problems with voice actors in a particular country or some such thing, then we've got the capacity to be able to remedy that situation and still deliver the project on time. So those numbers are sort of reflect kind of where we said, okay, for the next period, we'll do this many hours, and we'll kind of work with our clients in order to adjust things in order to meet that kind of level. So clearly what you'd like to do is to see those numbers and say, well, multiply that number of hours by this blended number, and that will give us a number. And it's very hard to do that because those 150 hours we're doing at the moment, you know, if they were all voiceover dubs in for a single narrator, then that would yield a much smaller number than if they were lip sync dubs with, you know, 50 different voices that are needed. Also, these costs vary by language. So there's kind of variability. So again, when we're saying 150 hours, you've got no idea what languages those are in. So I'm not sure I can really help you in terms of giving you something that you can then plug in a model and say this is where it will come out. I mean, what I can say is that we're 5 years into subtitling, and over the course of the period we're reporting on here, we were doing almost 10,000 hours per month of subtitling. So the output that we were delivering back to clients in aggregate was about 10,000 hours per month. And obviously at the moment, we're doing 150 hours of dubbing. Now, as we know, because the cost of dubbing is so much greater than subtitling, that sort of skews the picture. And the demand for dubbing in terms of number of languages is lower than for dubbing than it is for subtitling. So a typical order that comes to us, there will be more subtitling languages than dubbed languages. So it's quite a complex.
So then the next issue is if one looks at the FinCAT forecasts, those seem to be quite conservative. You have explained to be quite conservative, but I suppose there are some negatives that are going on in terms of Blu-ray and DVD. So is that what's driving the extreme conservatism?
So as I touched on earlier, the visibility we have is really quite short. So other than that roughly $2 million of recurring software income that is pretty much banked, the rest is all repeatable business that, you know, comes in one day, is fulfilled within the next few weeks. So that visibility that we've got is really very short. So I think if you were an analyst writing research on us, would you, A, say, okay, Zoo delivered 73% growth last year, so let's assume we're going to do 73% in the year ahead, but maybe just scale it back a bit? Or would you, B, say, Zoo did $28.6 million worth of sales in the previous year, so probably they should be able to do the same plus a bit? And I think, given all the risk factors around the fact that our visibility is short, around the fact that there is still client concentration, clearly. So, you know, in theory, one of those clients could just decide not to order any localization anymore. I mean, it's a bit unthinkable, but you know, stranger things happen. So that there are so many risk factors that you'd have to, if you send it back from being real objective about it, you would say, well, that putting an aggressive forecast together is quite a bold thing to do. So I think what you're seeing in the forecast is the is a prudent look at the business, how it's moving forward, reflecting those risks, recognizing the fact that clearly a big element of our growth potentially will come from dubbing, which is much higher value in terms of what we would charge for those projects, yet we are still at very early stages in that. So I think when you put all those things together, I think you have to take, you know, if you were that analyst, I think you would probably take a prudent view.
Thank you.
You talk about the short window of being able to see forecasts, or because you get an order in and you fulfill it. As the volume ramps up on the dubbing side, will that inevitably mean there is scheduling of a higher level of scheduling of jobs being required, and hence you will actually begin to get a longer window of visibility?
I'm not sure I could speculate just at the moment what effect that might have. So I think in the industry, in terms of the traditional way in which dubbing is done, I think typically there is more visibility enjoyed by our competitors. Because, of course, because they're physical premises, they have to book that studio time. And they have to book, make sure they've got recording engineers on site and so on. So they need to give a fair bit of notice to that. You can't come back up at the last minute and say, I'd like you to do these 20 hours of dubbing for me and I need it by next Thursday. You'll need to book that ahead of time. So I think whilst in the industry today, it's usual practice to do that. I think the very fact that because our approach is so much more agile, I think clients will naturally just think, well, if it's Zoo, we won't need to give them that. I think a separate question is whether we could potentially have different kinds of relationships with clients that could give us a better visibility. And obviously, to the extent that that's possible, we'll seek to put that in place. But I think, again, I think we're just way too early in our rollout of these services.
I can fully understand what you're saying on the dubbing side. On the subtitling side, what is your experience there? Obviously, there's much bigger volumes there. So again, just talking about how far forward you can see in terms of being able to project revenues out.
So for subtitling, it is the norm in the industry that, you know, with all vendors, not just Zoo, that orders just come in and, you know, are expected to be turned around relatively quickly. I think generally, because of our approach, we can turn them around more quickly than average. And we can, because of our approach, we could also deliver them to a consistently high quality. Typically, the visibility that any company providing the services would have will be relatively short. And the big buyers, you know, take a, for reasons of de-risking their businesses, will tend to have a multi-vendor strategy. So they won't want to put all their eggs in one basket. So there are some, but it's quite rare situations where we have clients who essentially are giving us all their work. Usually they'll work with a number of providers.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.